Welcome to Open Your Eyes, a podcast about empowering each of us with the perspective and tools to grow and change. I hope you're having a great day to enjoy and be grateful for in life. And the way we approach each day can and does affect our mood, our decision-making, and our courage in pursuing our purpose in life. That's why we all need a little positive perspective to get our day started. And that's why I listen to podcasts. And I hope it's the reason why you listen to this podcast, Open Your Eyes. Don't ever doubt the power of setting our mind right each day. It has a lasting impact. So I hope today you hear something that can help you get a better view of your place in the world and how you can live to your potential. Let's get started. You know, we're all coaches. Whether we're a parent, a business leader, or a church youth leader, we find ourselves coaching in a variety of circumstances. Have we ever taken a class on how to be a better coach? Well, today I'd like to take a lesson or two from that class and talk about how you and I can be a more effective coach. Now, I'm a bit of a tennis fan, and there's nothing better than waking up on a Saturday morning and spending that morning watching tennis matches at Wimbledon or the U.S. Open. I remember September 8th, 2018, the U.S. Women's Final. The match was already a landmark event. On one side stood Serena Williams, 23-time Grand Slam champion, chasing a record-tying 24th major title after returning from maternity leave and a series of health scares. On the other side, Naomi Osaka, a rising 20-year-old star, soft-spoken off the court but fearsome on it, born in Japan and idolizing Serena since childhood. Her father was Haitian and her mother Japanese. Naomi was born into a cross-cultural household, and that would shape every aspect of her life. Her father, inspired by the Williams sisters and how their father coached them, decided to teach Naomi and her sister Mari tennis, even though he had never played the sport himself. "I just copied Richard Williams," he said. When Naomi was three, the family moved from Japan to Long Island, New York, and eventually settled in Florida so the girls could train year-round. At only 20, Naomi was a surprise to be in the final, where millions of people would come to know her name. It was a symbolic match, past versus the future, power versus poise, legend versus legacy in the making. But no one could have predicted the firestorm that would unfold. From the start, Osaka was locked in. Her serve was clicking. Her forehand was electric. She broke Serena early in the match and took the first set 6-2. This, in and of itself, was a surprise. Was Serena past her prime? Serena, known for her comebacks, tried to rally. But in the second set, the emotional tone of the match shifted dramatically. At 1-0 in the second set, chair umpire Carlos Ramos suddenly and out of the blue issued Serena a code violation for coaching, spotting hand signals from her coach, Patrick Mouratoglou, in the stands. For most of modern tennis history, coaching during matches was prohibited at Grand Slam events and most tournaments. The official rule was simple. Players shall not receive coaching during a match, verbal or nonverbal. This meant no hand signals, nor gestures, no whispered advice from the stands. But in practice, despite the rule, coaching was rampant, quietly accepted and inconsistently enforced. Coaches routinely used hand signals and eye contact and sometimes direct coaching. Everybody knew it happened, but umpires rarely called it, especially at high-stakes moments. It was like speeding on a highway, technically illegal, but almost everyone did it, and you only got punished if you were unlucky. In recent history, only a few times has coaching been called in a major tournament. In the 2010 Wimbledon final, Rafael Nadal's uncle, a longtime coach Tony Nadal, was warned and later fined for allegedly coaching from the stands. In a women's match in the Australian Open in 2008, the rule was also enforced. Now, at the U.S. Open, the camera showed Serena's coach. He definitely made a gesture with both hands and mouthed words to Serena. It was clear and obvious. But for the umpire to call the violation at this time in the match, when Serena was losing and tension was high and so much was on the line, seemed strange by almost everyone. Serena approached the chair calmly but firmly. "I don't cheat to win," she said. "I'd rather lose. I'm just letting you know." This wasn't just about tennis for Serena. She was struggling. It was obvious she was not going to win and maybe it struck a personal chord with her. Now, note that later her coach would admit he was coaching, something nearly every coach does, but Serena insisted she hadn't seen it and wouldn't accept the implication. But again, the cameras saw her making eye contact. The issue for me and others watching was, why did the umpire call something like this during a finals match? Everyone coaches. Frustrated by her errors and missed opportunities, Serena smashed her racket after losing a game. That brought violation number two and a point penalty for racket abuse. Serena was stunned. She argued that the earlier coaching warning shouldn't count towards a cumulative penalty. Her voice raised, her energy flared. But Ramos, the umpire, followed the rulebook strictly. Serena, visibly upset, continued to confront Ramos during the changeovers. "You stole a point from me. You're a thief." Calling the umpire a thief prompted violation number three, verbal abuse. That resulted in a game penalty, giving Naomi Osaka a 5-3 lead in the second set, one game away from victory. With this, the crowd erupted in boos. Serena was livid and devastated. "This has happened to me too many times," she said. "This is not fair. It's because I'm a woman and you're going to take this away from me." Now, she may have had a good point. In many matches over many years, it was obvious that men yelled and smashed their rackets and did many things without being called by the umpire. But here was this umpire not giving Serena any grace. Was it because she was a woman? Maybe. Well, Osaka held her serve and won the match 6-2, 6-4, becoming the first Japanese player, man or woman, to win a Grand Slam title. But the moment of triumph was heartbreakingly complex. As she walked to the net, Osaka looked unsure of how to react. The crowd booed, not at her, but at the situation and the umpire and the awkwardness of it all. Osaka covered her face with her visor, and during the trophy ceremony, she was in tears. Serena, showing a bit of grace, turned to the crowd and asked them to give Osaka credit where credit was due. And Serena would later be fined $17,000 for her behavior. The fallout was huge. The WTA and Billie Jean King voiced support for Serena. Others felt she crossed the line with the umpire. Carlos Ramos was kept off of matches with her for a time. Naomi Osaka, meanwhile, showed resilience and humility and would go on to win three more Grand Slam titles. Did Serena's coach Patrick make a mistake in being so obvious in his coaching? Yes, anyone would agree. But I'm sure, seeing his player, who he had coached for many years, in a moment of struggle, he wanted to help her in any way he could. That's the way it is with coaching. We all make mistakes from time to time, and we think we're helping our team, but for a variety of reasons, our attempts at coaching aren't effective or done at the right time. And the truth is, coaching is an art. It requires skill, understanding, and it's not easy. People have different skills and emotions and levels of maturity, and one method of coaching may not work with all people. So, whether you are coaching a business team, teenagers, a sports team, or any other group of people, let's explore some key coaching skills that we can all put into place and see if we can learn from some of the best coaches, including Patrick, who coached Serena, Coco Gauff, and other major athletes. Here's the first lesson, and we take it from the basketball court. Pat Summitt was the legendary head coach of the University of Tennessee Lady Vols basketball team. Over her 38-year career, she won 8 national championships, over 1,000 games, and became the winningest coach in NCAA basketball history, men or women at the time. But what made her a legend wasn't just the wins, it was how she coached. In 1997, the Lady Vols were in the Final Four, facing tough odds. Their star player, Chamonique Holdsclaw, was only a freshman. The team was good, but young and inconsistent. Before the semifinal game, the team was jittery. The lights were too bright, the pressure was getting to them. And Pat Summitt didn't have a tactical speech. Instead, she stared at her players, blue eyes blazing, and said, "You have everything you need to win this game. Stop doubting. Start believing." Then she looked directly at Holdsclaw, who had struggled with nerves all season, and said, "You're not a freshman anymore. You're a leader. Act like it." Those few sentences flipped a switch in the locker room. Holdsclaw played like a veteran. The team clicked. They stormed through the Final Four and won the national title. It was the start of three championships in a row. Afterward, Chamonix said in an interview, "Coach Summit scared me and inspired me. She didn't see just who I was. She saw who I could be, and she never let me settle for less." That's such a great lesson. Great coaches don't coach who people are. They coach who they can be. For years, I've used this simple illustration. What if you knew your 8-year-old son would grow up to be a world-renowned heart surgeon? I mean, it was clear. It would happen. It was certain. How would you treat him? How would you coach him? When he failed his first science test, what would you do? Would you make sure he had experiences when he was young to gain confidence in science? How would you talk to him about his potential? Yes, it's likely you would coach him based on who he could become and not so much on who he was today. This is incredibly important. The image coaches create in the minds of their team members of who they can become is powerful. Henrik Jontz, the famous philosopher, said, "Mental anticipation now pulls the future into the present and reverses the direction of causality." In other words, the image you create of yourself or of others for them pulls who they can be into their current reality and begins to cause it to come to pass. On your team or with your teenagers, have you focused on who they can be? What if you held in your mind the person they could be, and when they interacted with you, this was dominant in what they felt? Your language would be different, the feelings between you would be different. And this leads to our second principle of coaching. Great coaches are potentiators. Potentiators have a unique quality that encompasses the ability to be a first-class noticer. Now, this phrase, first-class noticer, came from author Warren Bennis, and he used it based on his observations of some of the world's best leaders. He saw that they paid attention, and they were noticing the possibilities in people and circumstances all the time. Potentiators see the subtle possibilities and the latent skills in people. In helping others see their potential, these great coaches use language and examples that are plain and easy to understand. They get to the essence of the matter. When my managers give performance reviews, I encourage them to coach on only one or two things, one or two ways to improve, and keep their language clear and simple. Don't overcomplicate things. Great coaches are simple in their approach. Now, if you go all the way back to 1988, the Notre Dame Fighting Irish football team was undefeated, heading into a clash with the number one ranked Miami Hurricanes, a team so dominant and brash that they were nicknamed the Bad Boys of college football. Miami was fast, physical, and full of swagger. Notre Dame, under the coach Lou Holtz, was disciplined, old school, and out to prove themselves. The media dubbed the game Catholics versus convicts. Emotions were sky high. Tensions boiled over before the game even started. A pregame tunnel fight broke out between the teams. Players had to be separated. Security was called in. Everyone assumed that Lou Holtz would deliver a fire and brimstone speech to match the chaos. But when he gave his speech to his team, what he said surprised them. Holtz gathered the team and said, "You don't need to get emotional. You don't need to talk tough. Save your energy for between the white lines." And then he paused, looked at them, and said, "You don't have to make history today. You just have to play like you belong in it." Boom. No yelling, no theatrics, just belief. He reminded them to be themselves. Great coaches see the entire field of life, and they are simple and clear. The game was a battle. Notre Dame fought tooth and nail. There were controversial calls, fumbles, gutsy plays, and a one-line goal stand that sealed the game late in the fourth quarter. The final score? Notre Dame 31, Miami 30. And that win launched them to a national championship and into the college football legend. Here's the point. Lou Holtz coached identity and who they were. In a moment where chaos reigned, he centered his team on who they were. Well, after the game, Holtz deflected credit and praised his players, but anyone watching knew this was coaching at its finest. He turned a locker room of nervous young men into a team that believed they were history makers, and they were. So, be clear and simple. Speak with perspicuity, which is the quality of being clear and easily understood. At times, remind your team of who they are and bring them back to the simple things they need to win. Now, I've used this simple lesson many times with my children, even my adult children who have come to me for advice. I remind them of who they are. Often I'll tell them that they are first a child of God, that He sees them in an eternal sense, that He is patiently waiting for them to make choices with His perspective and not their day-to-day perspective. Recently, my youngest daughter came to me after having her first baby, wanting to know my advice as to whether she should work part-time or stay home with her baby. I asked her questions like, what will help your son grow and be healthy? What will help you be an emotionally healthy person and feel like you're making a contribution in the world? I didn't give her direct advice. I knew it had to be her decision because she had to learn from the consequences and it needed to be her responsibility. But the questions I asked her helped her decide what to do. And this leads to our next coaching skill. Have perspective that is above those you coach and at times micro in its view, as you have empathy for their circumstances. Great coaches have a maturity, like a mother's intuition, a sense of higher purpose, and a vision for the future. Great coaches are highly developed and able to view the landscape from multiple perceptions. They work to gain understanding of viewpoints and values other than their own. They navigate easily within relationships and diverse situations, honoring the many perspectives that their team members have from diverse backgrounds. Great coaches suspend prejudgment to allow for an infinite amount of possibilities, despite the fact that given the follower's current level of understanding or development, it may seem limited. Now, for one of my favorite coaching examples, we must travel back to Lake Placid, New York, the 1980 Winter Olympics, and a group of mostly unknown college hockey players coached by Herb Brooks. They were amateurs, underdogs, not expected to make it past the first round. Their task? Face the Soviet Union, a team so dominant they'd won gold in 5 of the last 6 Olympics, sometimes beating professional NHL players with ease. The Soviets were machines, the Americans, a bunch of kids. Well, Brooks was hired not just to coach hockey, but to build a team. And from day one, he made it clear he wasn't there to be liked, he was there to win. I'm not looking for the best players, he said. I'm looking for the right players. That meant challenging egos and demanding more than anyone thought possible. He worked them to exhaustion. He pushed their limits physically and mentally. One infamous practice, after a lazy exhibition game against Norway, came after the game, and he made them skate sprints for over an hour. Brooks knew they needed more than skill. They needed discipline, fire, unity, identity. He worked tirelessly to help them learn the game and get into shape and develop the skills to work together as a team. On February 22, 1980, Team USA faced the Soviet Union in the medal round. No one gave the U.S. a real shot, but something clicked. They were outshot, outskated, but not outplayed. Brooks didn't yell. He didn't overcoach. At one critical moment, he simply said, "You were born to be hockey players. You were meant to be here. And this moment is yours." With less than 10 minutes to go, Team USA took a 4-3 lead. Brooks didn't call a timeout. He trusted them. As the final seconds ticked down, broadcaster Al Michaels famously shouted, "Do you believe in miracles?" Team USA had pulled off one of the greatest upsets in sports history. They didn't just beat the Soviets, they changed the game. Now, Herb Brooks wasn't just a coach. He was an architect of belief. He coached character. He didn't just train players. He sought to transform them into something stronger, a team with heart. And the truth is that great coaching isn't about comfort. It takes work, and you don't always have to be liked. Great coaching at times requires tough decisions. Brooks would later say that all the coaching wasn't for a hockey game, meaning he was creating players and men that could lead themselves, and he armed them with character that would last. For example, on your team today, there may be a person who doesn't keep their promises. They say that this month they'll show up for meetings and generate new leads or deliver on business goals, but they don't put forth the effort. Coaches in this situation maybe need to be direct and clear in a way that helps the person come along in their accountability and commitment. "Jan, you didn't do what you said you would do last month. I'm committed to helping you reach your goals, but this month will require a higher level of effort." Direct, clear, supportive. Now, I have, over the years, learned some other key skills when coaching. The first is the use of the pause. Silence sometimes is magic. And after someone says something, don't rush to fill the air. Let the moment breathe. That's where the insight often emerges. I found that pausing encourages others to talk, and they usually know the right answer. And when it's their idea, they perform better. The next is the use of the mirror question. For example, if someone on your team saw your effort this month, what do you think they would say about it? This is the type of mirroring question that helps get quicker clarity. Sometimes it hurts, but sometimes it's joyful. For example, I had a meeting this week with a junior developer in our organization, and he did some incredible work at updating a key tool used by many of our team members. After he showed me this work, I asked him a mirroring question. What do you think our guest experience staff will think of this? He said, they will think it's a huge help to what they already do, but they'd likely look for it to be more user-friendly. I then asked him, what are you going to do? He said, make it more user-friendly. Great coaches stand as a mirror in allowing others to see themselves and their work from a different perspective. The next coaching skill is to flip the story. Oftentimes, people have fixed narratives like, my kid is rebellious or my employee is lazy. But the coaching skill is to flip the narrative with questions like, well, what else could be true? Famous tennis player Coco Gauff wrote about her coach, Patrick, and his ability to help her change her perspective when she wrote. That moment of change came in 2023 when my own coach had to step aside. Because of this, my self-confidence plummeted. I had been with him when I reached my first Grand Slam final at the French Open in 2022, and I didn't believe that I could find that kind of success with any other coach. Then Patrick stepped in. He recognized immediately that I had lost a tremendous amount of confidence and self-esteem. He set about helping me regain it straight away. How? By simplifying the game for me, by reminding me why I had fallen in love with tennis in the first place. You see, young players tend to overcomplicate things, and I was no different. There were so many parts of my game that I felt I needed to work on. The more I thought about it, the less confident I had become in my ability to do it. It was almost paralyzing, and Patrick helped me push all of that aside and taught me how to focus on the game itself. His briefings before a match were remarkable in their pure simplicity. Follow the game plan, he would say. So that's what I did. And over time, as I rediscovered my joy and passion for the sport, my confidence in my abilities and positive mindset returned. I started to win again. Believe me, I understand what it feels like to think you aren't good enough to achieve your goals. I'm also equally familiar with the damage we do to our self-esteem when we take every misstep, every mistake, every loss as an indictment of our abilities. My advice? Don't overcomplicate it. It's a simple game. Coach Patrick said, the greatest obstacle you will face in your life is in your own mind. Seemingly, at every turn, your mind tries to sabotage your progress. Why? Well, the mind is designed to keep you safe, and it does this by convincing you to avoid failure. Conversely, the greatest weapon you have against life's challenges is also your mind. When it is properly prepared and attuned to work for you and your goals, not against you. The chasm between these two contradictory mindsets is the difference between a life lived comfortably but without success and one that thrives on overcoming obstacles and accomplishing goals. Now, I learned a great lesson from Patrick, who is Coco and Serena's tennis coach, when I read his book. I learned the term progress zone. The progress zone is the exact opposite of comfort zone. His goal as a coach was to keep his team members in the progress zone. He said, dreams are cheap. When dreams only live in your head, it costs you nothing to keep them there. And that's where they will stay unless you leave your comfort zone. So how do you take your dreams and make them real? Here's how. You leave your comfort zone by setting goals and achieving them. Wait, aren't goals just another word for dreams? It certainly can be, but not in a way I'm using either word. Dreams, properly understood, are motivations. They are the fuel that gets you going. But the dream itself isn't what you're trying to accomplish. Every tennis player wants to be a champion. That's their dream. and it excites them, makes them work hard, keeps them up at night, and it gets them up in the morning, but it doesn't make them win. Achieving goals does that. To help illustrate the point, I'll share some real goals one of my players wrote down. These were her goals for a particular match. First, play deep. Every time I hit the ball, I want to push the opponent back. Why? Because I protect myself from attacks and it potentially creates short balls that allow me to control the rally. Second goal, play aggressive and make the opponent run. Third goal, stay positive. How? Play every point like a new challenge. When I miss, I stay excited and enthusiastic because I have the opportunity on the next point. Talk to myself in a way that will keep me constantly in that mindset. I love Patrick's approach here. The coach's job is to take dreams and reduce them to practical goals that can help the team member thrive. I often hear people talk as if goals are something that are out of favor or not popular or not able to do the heavy lifting in a coach's toolkit. But nothing could be further from the truth. Goals help us pursue the tactics and specific actions that lead to making dreams a reality. This zone of setting clear goals and reaching them is what Patrick calls the progress zone. His formula for success? Always live in the progress zone. The next coaching skill I'd like to recommend is a three-question exercise. It's powerful, and I use it all the time. Here are the three questions you can ask a team member. What are you doing now? What is it costing you? And what do you want instead? Sometimes I find my team gets a bit off track and they're focusing on the less important, or they brainstorm their way out of focus. These three questions help us get back on track to who we are and what we should be doing. This is what great coaches do. And as we end today, remember a lasting coaching principle. Confidence is always developed by action. If your team member is lacking confidence, doubting, or if your teenager is faltering in their life goals, if you're struggling with motivation, start acting. It is in the action where confidence is found, and great coaches know this. So try a few of these coaching lessons this week and watch. You'll find your team responding better to the coaching you have to offer. Most of all, thanks for being here today. And don't forget to join us next week for another podcast as we seek to open our eyes to who and what we can become.